Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave, Part 6.
Does moral virtue have value even if we are deprived of all other goods? Is moral virtue alone enough to guarantee at least a modicum of happiness? Many interpreters have claimed that Socrates was indeed endorsing the value of moral virtue alone when he made this famous statement in Plato's early dialogue entitled Apology.
No harm comes to a good man in life or in death.
But this common interpretation is almost certainly mistaken. In an early dialogue entitled Crito, Socrates clearly implies that disease can render life to be no longer worth living. He asks Crito if it's worth living when one has a diseased or corrupted body.
Come then, if we ruin what becomes better by health and is destroyed by disease, because we listen to the opinion of the ignorant, is life worth living? And that thing is the body, is it not? And is life worth living with a diseased and corrupted body?
Crito's answer is never, and Socrates agrees. Much the same point is made towards the end of the dialogue entitled Gorgias. Here, Socrates explains why ship captains should not think they have necessarily done their passengers a great favor by guiding them safely through the dangers on the sea.
If anyone afflicted with great and incurable diseases of the body is not drowned, he is miserable at not having been killed, and he has not benefited from the safe passage he has been given.
Moral virtue cannot protect the body from disease, and a disease that's chronically disabling can make someone very unhappy. So Socrates concludes that moral virtue alone cannot guarantee happiness. His comments about the relationship between virtue and happiness imply that sometimes even the virtuous are better off dead. So what can it possibly mean for Socrates to say that a good man cannot be harmed in life or in death? We've already seen that Socrates believes human beings have souls, which are radically different kinds of things from our bodies. A soul may become better off or worse off due to something that doesn't touch the body. Similarly, something that helps or harms the body may leave the soul untouched. So in saying that no harm comes to a good man, Socrates probably means that nothing can damage a good man's soul. We know that Socrates appears to reject the idea that moral virtue can guarantee happiness, but is virtue necessary for happiness? In other words, can a person who is not virtuous ever become happy? It's worth noting that Socrates professed to lack the moral wisdom that's necessary for virtue, so if virtue is necessary for happiness, then Socrates must not have been happy, even if he lived a life that was free from injustice. An even greater paradox is that if Socrates were to say that virtue is necessary for happiness, he would have to infer that no one else in Athens is happy either. He has examined a great many people as a part of his divine mission, and no one has been able to pass his tests. In Plato's Apology, Socrates' final speech to the jury strongly suggests that a person can be happy without virtue. Socrates also seems to regard himself as happy. After being convicted and sentenced to die, Socrates tells those who voted for his acquittal that they should be hopeful about death.
Either death is nothingness and the end of all perception, or it happens to be a change, as they say, and a migration of the soul from this place here to another place. If it is the end of perception, like sleep, in which the sleeper sees not a single dream, death would be a wonderful gain. But if death is a move from here to another place, and what they say is true, that all the dead are there, what greater good could there be? What would you give to examine the leader of the great army against Troy, or Odysseus, or Sisyphus, or the multitude of others, men and women, I might mention? Oh, to converse with, and be with, and to examine those there would be an indescribable happiness.
Of course, Socrates is not claiming to know which of the two possibilities will occur at death, but he thinks that anyone should be happy to examine those who exist in the underworld. Socrates cannot plausibly believe that one suddenly acquires moral virtue at death, so he must think that it is possible to be happy without virtue, provided that there is philosophical examination. If this is right, then Socrates has good reason to count himself as happy in this life. After all, he engages whenever he can in the very thing that he says would make for happiness in the afterlife. This is not to say that Socrates regards his happiness as equal to what the truly virtuous would enjoy. He views the knowledge possessed by the virtuous as analogous to that possessed by a craftsman. For example, an architect knows not only which columns will support a given edifice, he also knows which columns will do so most effectively. To know architecture, then, is to know what is the best sort of structure in light of the user's needs and the quality of the materials at hand. Similarly, Socrates believes that moral knowledge is knowing the best moral course out of the countless options available. Socrates' life of right conduct allows him to say he is happy, but he has no reason to think that he is engaging in the best actions possible. His life and his happiness is inferior to that of the virtuous, if such persons exist. Socrates often talks about moral virtue as if it is one thing, but he is perfectly comfortable talking about the many individual virtues, wisdom, self-control, courage, justice, and piety. So what is the relationship of these individual virtues to each other and to virtue as a whole? In Plato's dialogue entitled Protagoras, Socrates poses this very question to the great sophist Protagoras.
Are the five names, wisdom, temperance, courage, justice, and piety, names for the same thing? Or is there some individual essence that underlies each, and a thing that has its own function, so that it is not possible for each to be different from the others?
Protagoras holds the common sense view that each of the virtues is essentially different. It is like a part of the face. Socrates recapitulates Protagoras' view.
You said that they are not names attached to a single being, but that each of these names refers to a distinct thing, and that all are parts of virtue. Not as pieces of gold are like each other and to the whole of which they are parts, but like the parts of the face, unlike the whole of which they are parts, and unlike each other, each having its own individual function.
But what does Socrates himself think? Today, most scholars agree that at least in his conversation with Protagoras, Socrates thinks the virtues are more like pieces of gold. They are essentially the same thing. To have any one of the virtues is ipso facto to have all of the virtues, or what we might call the whole of virtue. Socrates thus accepts what has been called the unity of the virtues. This notion that the virtues are unified is confirmed by a discussion between Socrates and the Athenian general Nicias in Plato's dialogue entitled Laches. Here, Nicias begins by saying that he thinks courage is only a part of virtue, and he defines courage as the knowledge of what is to be feared and dared. Socrates quickly points out that fearing and daring pertain to the future, while knowledge of something applies to past, present, and future.
It seems to me that about the things to which knowledge pertains, there is not one knowledge of how something came about, and another of how something comes about, and still another of what has not yet happened, but might or will happen in the best way. Really, it is the same knowledge for all three. For example, concerning health, medicine. One thing oversees what comes about, what has come about, and what will come about. And concerning the things that are produced by the earth, farming overseas in the same way. And surely, in matters pertaining to war, you yourself will be my witness that generalship best forecasts the other matters and what will happen. So, if you agree with me, you will think that courage is knowledge not only of what is to be feared and dared, but it comprehends what happens and what will happen, and in all ways, just as is true of the other branches of knowledge. And now, as it seems, according to your own account, knowledge is not of what is to be feared and dared, but of virtually all goods and evils in every way.
It's not clear whether Socrates thinks anyone can actually have such broad powers of discernment. After all, if the virtues are unified, as Socrates says they are, then anyone would have to have a fantastically vast range of experience and expertise in order to qualify as a morally virtuous person. In Socrates' time, as in our own, many people recognized what was in their own best interest, but failed to do it. We might call this phenomenon weakness of will, but the Greeks called it akrasia. Examples of this are endless. People know they should stop smoking, but choose to go on even while knowing it harms their health. Many people know they should read good literature, but they continue to watch as much television as ever. People say they should lose weight, but they continue to eat excessively. According to Aristotle, Socrates denies that weakness of will really exists, and he considers the examples that supposedly illustrate such a thing to be importantly misleading. Aristotle reports,
"Some say that it is impossible to have knowledge that something is wrong, and yet to act against that knowledge. It would be strange, so Socrates thought, that if, when one has knowledge, something else would control it and drag it about like a slave." Socrates was completely opposed to the view, holding instead that there is no such thing as akrasia. No one decides to act contrary to what he thinks is best, but does so through ignorance.
How can Socrates make such an extraordinary conclusion? Consider his discussion with Meno, who initially expresses the conventional view that people sometimes act against their interests. Socrates begins,
"Do all men seem to you to desire good things?"
"No, indeed."
"Some desire evil things?"
"Yes."
"Believing the evils to be goods, do you mean? Or knowing that they are evil, they nevertheless desire them?"
"There are both sorts of persons, it seems to me."
"And does one who selects an evil believe that he is benefited by it, or does he know that it harms the one who possesses it?"
"There are those who believe they are benefited by the evil, and those who know they are harmed by it."
"Well then, the one who desires evil, as you say, believing it will harm the one who gets it, do they know they will be harmed by it?"
"Necessarily."
"And do they think that those who are harmed are miserable, in so far as they are harmed?"
"This too must be."
"Are the miserable unhappy?"
"I think so."
Now, Socrates proceeds to the core of his argument.
"But is there anyone who wants to be miserable and unhappy?"
"I don't think so."
"Then, Meno, no one wants evil things if he does not want to be unhappy. For what is misery other than desiring evils and procuring them?"
Socrates is driven to claim that no one is ever weak-willed, and his impulse to do this is sometimes called his extreme intellectualism. Socrates believes that every desire aims at what a person takes to be his or her own good. Thus, whenever people knowingly act in a harmful way, as when they overeat, Socrates says they really believe the practice to be in their overall interest. Socrates is essentially saying that wickedness always results from ignorance. the wicked simply fail to grasp that vice is bad for them. Socrates spent his life examining others, and his experiences convinced him that the best thing you can do for yourself is to pursue moral virtue. The worst thing you can do is to become morally corrupt. In light of this conviction, it is not surprising to hear Socrates say that tyrants who use their power to harm others are not really doing what they want to do. Although they don't realize it, the tyrants are actually harming themselves, which no one wants to do. In Plato's dialogue entitled Gorgias, Socrates makes this point in a conversation with a young man named Polus. Socrates begins,
"We want the good, as you say, and we do not want what is neither good nor evil, nor do we want evil. Then if we agree on these points, if someone kills another, or casts him out of the city, or seizes his money, whether he is a tyrant or an orator, thinking it is better for him to do so, though he happens to do what is evil, such a person does what he thinks is right for him, doesn't he?"
"Yes."
"But is it what he wants, if it happens to be evil? Why do you not answer?"
"No, it doesn't seem to me that he does what he wants."
"Does such a person have the power to do great things in that city? If great power is something good, according to what you have agreed to?"
"He does not."
This interchange shows how Socrates' conversations can lead to conclusions or beliefs that are utterly at odds with those of most people. Of course, he agrees with most people that being well off requires getting what one wants. But if Socrates is right, those who harm others with impunity are actually harming themselves, even though they think they are getting what they want. They only have the illusion of getting what they want, when what they really want is to be happy. But this requires moral virtue, which is the last thing they say they want. People who harm others fail to pursue what they really want because of their ignorance. They simply don't know that virtue is what is really good for them. Socrates' concept of moral virtue has profound implications for politics. In Athens, as Socrates knew it, there were two major competing political factions. First, there were the oligarchs, who wanted only landowners to be Athenian citizens. The oligarchs typically sympathized with the authoritarian culture of Sparta. The second major political group in ancient Athens was composed of the Democrats, who favored a much broader participation in every aspect of Athenian political life. The Democrats were almost invariably hostile to Sparta. Some scholars have argued that Socrates was an avid oligarch, while others have argued that he was a friend of democracy. Plato's Apology seems to tell us that Socrates belonged to neither faction. He simply has no politics. According to the Apology, Socrates claimed that his daimonion warned him away from an active life of politics. If we listen carefully, we see that Socrates' remarks in the Apology do not settle the question of which political faction he supported.
"Do you think I could have carried on so many years if I acted in public settings, and in doing what a good man does, I lent aid to the just, and attached the greatest importance to this? Not at all. Nor could any other man."
Socrates' refusal to act in the political arena is entirely consistent with supporting either of the two major parties. So the question remains, did the principles held by Socrates incline him to favor one political faction over the other? Xenophon portrayed Socrates as being clearly hostile to democracy. He reported a conversation in which Socrates berated Charmides for being needlessly bashful about speaking before the assembly.
"You are ashamed to speak before the most senseless and weak people. Are you shamed by the fullers or the cobblers? Or the builders, or the smiths, or the merchants, or those who change money in the marketplace and who think about buying low and selling high? for the assembly is made up of these people.
According to Xenophon's account, Socrates thought that allowing the common folk to run the affairs of state is not just unwise, it is dangerous. Some historians have suspected that Xenophon's portrait of Socrates merely reflected Xenophon's own hostility to democracy. But we also find some of the same attitude ascribed to Socrates in the pages of Plato. Plato portrays Socrates as one who loses few opportunities to criticize the judgment of oi polloi, or average people, and these are the very people that the Athenian Democrats thought should make up the government. According to Plato, Socrates said,
"Concerning right and wrong, and the disgraceful and the noble, and the good and the bad, ought we to follow and fear the opinion of the majority, or that of the one individual, if there is one, who can advise us, whom it is necessary to hold in respect more than all the others? Unless we follow him, we will destroy and maim that which is benefited by justice and is ruined by injustice."
This is the end of part 6. Please download part 7 to continue.